From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Washington Bureau Chief of the Christian Science Monitor, Linda Feldman, and VOA Midwest correspondent, Kane Farabaugh. Welcome, Linda and Kane.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Kim.
Well, here are the issues. President Biden calls for a return to power sharing in Northern Ireland, where he visited to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. The peace deal helped end 30 years of violent conflict in Northern Ireland. Biden's multi-day trip included a meeting with Irish President Michael D. Higgins and a visit to County Mayo, where he has ancestral ties. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the U.S. is investigating the recent purported leak of classified documents until the source of them was found. The leak could have serious implications for Ukraine's efforts to fight off Russia's unprovoked invasion of the country. In Louisville, Kentucky, a 25-year-old bank employee armed with an AR-15 rifle shot five colleagues, killing them and wounding nine other people at his workplace. Louisville police released video of the officer's response to the attack, which has left one officer in critical condition. Police said the gunman was fatally shot at the scene. The incident marked the latest in a long series of mass shootings in the U.S. A federal appeals court ruled an abortion pill will remain available in the U.S. for now, but with significant restrictions, including a requirement for in-person doctor visits to obtain the drug. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, Linda, President Biden said he hopes Northern Ireland parties will return to power sharing soon during his trip there. What did he accomplish on this trip?
Well, as we're taping, he's still midway through. So he's finished his visit to Northern Ireland, and now he's in Dublin. First of all, it's important to note that Joe Biden is perhaps our most Irish president ever, maybe in competition only with John F. Kennedy. So this is as much a kind of personal ancestral homecoming to him as it is, you know, an important diplomatic mission. That said, the geopolitics of this, particularly pertaining to Brexit and to keeping the peace on the island, are quite significant. He met with Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister. That was key because Sunak was critical to winning the backing of Parliament last month for a kind of reworked post-Brexit deal on Northern Ireland that keeps Brexit going. Ireland is divided between Northern Ireland and Ireland, and Northern Ireland is part of the UK. And so that has long been a sticking point in the Brexit deal. Ireland didn't want to be divided over trade issues. So keeping that was key. He also dangled $6 billion of investment in Ireland to incentivize Northern Ireland to stick with this process.
You know, there are some things here which have a lot to do with the public optics of his trip. As Linda mentioned, perhaps the only president that might be more popular in Northern Ireland or the Republic of Ireland would be John F. Kennedy. So as Biden makes his way through both areas of Ireland, he's obviously meeting people that are happy he's there. But this is about as low-key or as under the radar a visit as a U.S. president might be able to make. If you notice, and if you're looking on some of the websites, I mean, this is the story that's not rising to the top of most news events. But there is a lot that is occurring there with Biden's visit that has a lot to do with the status of Brexit and with the ability for the government of the United Kingdom to pursue its Brexit policies. But the interesting thing here, too, is that while Prime Minister Rishi Sunak met with President Biden when he arrived, there's been some commentary in the British media that Prime Minister Rishi Sunak did not participate in any of President Biden's public appearances in Northern Ireland. And I think as he makes his way through the rest of this trip, how much that means something has yet to be seen. I think, though, in large part, this is more or less something that perhaps President Biden is hoping resonates maybe more domestically here in the United States politically, with over 30 million Americans being able to claim Irish ancestry and the popularity of some of these TV shows like Who Do You Think You Are and Finding Your Roots with Henry Louis Gates. You know, President Biden returning to his ancestral homeland is something that a lot of Americans, especially the 30 million that live in this country that have that Irish descent, probably look to and it appeals to. But a lot of this is for optics and to draw attention again to the peace process now, which has enabled there to be relative peace on that island now for 25 years.
Yeah, I predict we might get a few Biden reelection campaign ads out of this visit. I mean, probably a day doesn't go by when Biden isn't quoting an Irish poet or referring to his Irish ancestors. When he landed in Dublin, he joked, "I'm not going home." So maybe he's ready to defect to Ireland. Who knows?
But do you think the president's visit to Ireland was overshadowed by these leaks of U.S. classified documents?
Oh, absolutely. And again, too, I'm just doing this anecdotally by telling you how, as I'm scouring the different news sites about what is making headlines, President Biden's trip to Northern Ireland is not making the big headlines. What is making the headlines here are all of these issues that we seem to be dealing with here at home, and that is with the leaks. It also has to do with abortion access. All of this is rising well above President Biden's trip to Ireland.
Yes, and also in looking at these leaks, they are said to be the biggest of classified documents in a decade and has created a crisis in Washington this week. How is Washington handling the damage control?
I can't overstate how huge this is. I was at the briefing in the White House earlier this week, and John Kirby, the communications director for the National Security Council, he spoke, and the sense of, I don't even know what the right word is, but horror at what has happened. So look at Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Look at Lloyd Austin. Look at John Kirby. They've never lived through anything like this, at least since in the last 10 years. We're still now piecing together where this might come from. They obviously have to get to the bottom of this. The Washington Post had a very interesting article actually looking at who they say was the leaker. Apparently, it's a young man who is a young, charismatic gun enthusiast who, and I'm quoting from the Post, who shared highly classified documents with a group of far-flung acquaintances searching for companionship amid the isolation of the pandemic. So the thinking is that the intelligence that's leaked is largely derived from electronic sources and not human intelligence. Human intelligence is most highly classified, and obviously, if it leaks, it endangers the identities. So that if it's not based on human intelligence, at least that's something to feel okay about. But as I read the content of some of this intelligence, I almost feel guilty reading it because I know it's supposed to be secret, but it's out. And so we have to know what's in there. A lot of detail, for example, on infighting among Russian officials over the war, which is interesting to know. I mean, we see Russia has become so opaque as Putin has risen to authoritarian level rule. But just knowing that there is discord within the Russian elite is very interesting and gives us some window into how they're prosecuting the war, the kind of damage Russia has suffered, the casualties, the deaths. So I think, you know, as our government tries to figure out how this happened, we also need to digest what's in the documents and then take it from there.
Yeah, I think that, as Linda mentioned, too, because she's there in the Beltway, she's got the ability to directly report and cover on these topics as they're coming out and as these officials are addressing them. For those of us that live outside the Beltway, the interest is less in the process of how they became public and more in what they reveal. Just a couple of bullet points here or headlines about some of what these documents are indicating. Peace talks to end the war in Ukraine are probably not going to happen in 2023. That's one of the topics. Another one is showing that perhaps Egypt is trying to ship rockets to Russia. Obviously, Linda spoke there a bit about the infighting among the Russian officials, and that's all because of how to react and respond to the casualty numbers and what those numbers actually are. And so not just the deaths. I mean, Russian casualty figures are somewhere between like 190,000 and 250,000 casualties, which would be both injured and those who died on the battlefield. I mean, that is a large and remarkable number for an army that's still engaged in a direct war campaign on the eastern edges of its border with Ukraine right now and in disputed territory. So for all of us that are outside the Beltway looking at this, these details reveal to a public, not just the American public, but the world public, just how serious this war is, just how concerning it is to military leaders on all sides of this conflict about the length, the status, and the ability to fight this campaign as it continues. I mean, all of this is extremely revealing to the American public and shows us all a side of this conflict that perhaps we haven't seen before.
Yes, and when you look at some of the documents are said to be pointing to potential U.S. spying on South Korea, a major ally in the Indo-Pacific, support for Ukraine. So how are U.S. allies responding to this leak?
right now, just based on what we're able to gather and read from this, is that it's appalling. South Korea obviously wants to conduct its own investigation. They've indicated that they're going to look into these claims. I'm sure behind the scenes, there's probably some damage control on behalf of the United States. More interesting, too, I had mentioned before that these leaks indicate that Egypt, you know, sought to ship rockets to Russia. Well, they've just outright denied that that was the case. The reaction by the allies that are implicated in perhaps working with combatants in this war, you know, has been swift and quick denials. Sometimes you have to look beyond those to see what the truth of that matter is. And so I would say that there's probably a lot of behind the scenes damage control happening on behalf of the United States to probably reassure allies who are strongly connected, they're closely connected to the United States, that these circumstances are things that they're looking into and addressing.
I completely agree. I mean, this is such a monumental event in terms of how foreign and military policy are conducted. I mean, after the leaks 10 years ago, the Snowden leaks, I would think that everybody took a pause and realized that even though you think something you're saying is completely confidential and will never be made public, you have to assume that it might someday. So I suspect this will have a chilling effect going forward. And let's not forget also the other superpower, China, is watching this very closely. And, you know, with the recent drama over Taiwan and the Taiwanese president's presence in the United States, highly controversial, great fears that China will grab Taiwan. There wasn't as much in the documents about China as there was about Russia and Ukraine, but there was some in there. And we know the Chinese are watching very carefully and that they could potentially become involved in the war in Ukraine. So it's hard to underestimate how significant this development is.
And it would probably take years, not just weeks or days, to repair any damage that occurs from this. This is not something in which an investigation is going to quickly fix. You know, there's going to have to be years of diplomacy to probably rebuild the confidence measures that exist between the United States and its allies.
Yes, and we will continue to follow developments on this story. And it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, we'll have more discussion of Issues in the News. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, Washington Bureau Chief of the Christian Science Monitor, Linda Feldman, and VOA Midwest correspondent, Kane Farabaugh. Well, Louisville officials say the 25-year-old man who opened fire at a bank in downtown Louisville, Kentucky, killing five people, told at least one person that he was suicidal before the rampage and had legally purchased the AR-15-style rifle used in the shooting at a local dealership the week before the shooting. President Biden, he responded to news of this shooting by reiterating his wish that Congress pass legislation requiring safe storage of firearms, background checks for all gun sales, and elimination of gun manufacturers' immunity from liability. Does it look like President Biden's going to get his wish anytime soon with all these mass shootings now becoming so regular?
In a word, no. You know, Joe Biden has said, I think it was after the Nashville shooting, the mass shooting at the Christian school in Nashville, Tennessee, that he said he's done all he can by executive action and it's now up to Congress to act. And with divided Congress and very small margins of control in both houses, they did pass some modest measures last year, the first gun control legislation in 30 years. And I think for anything significant to happen, it's just beyond the political capabilities at this point.
You know, I think that we've all reached a point where many of us have just become numb to the reality that this is a continuing circumstance in the United States. You know, Kim, I think I was on an Issues in the News with you last year in which we also discussed a mass shooting. I have to say that I want to be shocked that there isn't some kind of unified response in U.S. government to these incidents because of the frequency in which they occur. But as Linda mentioned, it seems that there is no political will or political momentum to address these concerns, even though we know now the shooter in this latest incident was using an AR-15 assault rifle. And this has, in many of these instances, been the chosen weapon to carry out these shootings. And if it is difficult to be shocked, because of the frequency in which these things happen now, I must say that there is a new circumstance in these shootings because police officers who are responding to these incidents now are all wearing body cameras. The shooting in Nashville, the police department released the body cam footage that shows how police officers responded to the incident. The police cam footage has just been released in the Louisville shooting, and it shows the dramatic incident in the bank in which these police officers were engaged in. And so I think all of us who are watching these incidents on the news see these incidents now occurring from a first-person perspective because of the availability of this body camera footage. I guess the verdict is out on whether or not the ability to see this happen like that shifts attitudes about this in any way possible. But I have to say, and just in my own perspective, it has certainly shocked me just watching that footage as it's been released by the police departments. I know that the police departments are probably releasing this footage because they want to show that officers act quickly when they respond to these incidents, because the shooting in Texas that happened last year, there was much debate and much scrutiny about how quickly the officers responded to these incidents. It's clear that police officers are attempting to show that when these things happen, lately anyway, that police officers are responding as forcefully and as quickly as they possibly can to end the crisis. But I don't know if you've seen the footage, Linda, but when you watch this from that first person perspective, it makes it all that much more shocking.
I was thinking of how terribly the police handled the Uvalde, Texas shooting, and thinking, well, as terrible as it was this time, it could have been much worse, which is pretty sobering thought. Can we also say a little bit about the Nashville situation and the Tennessee legislature? I thought that was just extraordinary.
The legislators that were in the Tennessee legislature, and because they joined a protest that was led by people in the galleries watching the proceedings, they joined in the protest using a bullhorn. The Republican-led legislature voted to oust two of the three lawmakers that engaged in, or at least participated with the protesters in that protest. And the two people that were expelled from the legislature, they were African-American legislators. The one woman who was spared by one vote was white. She was a white legislator. And there has been attention drawn to that circumstance. There was a racist element to the way in which these three legislators were dealt with. But remarkably, being expelled from that legislative body now, those lawmakers that were went back to their districts and were put right back into place by local bodies that sent them back to the Tennessee legislature. So as of right now, all of those people expelled are back in government and vowed to carry on the fight.
And these two guys are rock stars, right? Justin Jones and Justin Pearson, you know, both in their 20s, very outspoken. They're now rising stars in politics. And that's perhaps a positive offshoot of a really sad situation.
But it also illustrates the divide between the urban and rural areas of a state like Tennessee. Nashville is an urban metro area, and gun violence is a concern there. And these two lawmakers represent urban areas that have these issues and want to see something addressed there. However, the legislative body is made up of representative government from the entire state itself. And many of those other legislators that voted to expel these two lawmakers came from rural parts of the state in which they might not be seeing the kind of violence that they're seeing inside the urban areas. This is the rural-urban divide in a state government playing out in politics.
Thank you all for bringing up that very important aspect of this issue. And let's get on to our last topic, where an abortion pill will remain available in the U.S. for now, but with significant restrictions. And this is based on a federal appeals court ruling on Wednesday. How significant is this case when you're looking at just last year, we had the reversal of Roe v. Wade, which already curtailed abortion access?
This is incredibly important. So when Roe was overturned, this was obviously monumental, but for young women facing the prospect of an unwanted pregnancy, the availability of medication abortion gave them an out. It meant that they wouldn't necessarily have to travel for an abortion if they're in a state that severely restricts or bans abortion. And then suddenly this very anti-choice judge in Texas came along and in a legal ruling decided that the FDA more than 20 years ago had improperly approved mifepristone, which is one of the two drugs used for medication abortion. So the latest on this is that this has now gone to the Fifth Circuit, which is federal appeals court, a step below the Supreme Court, at a panel on the Fifth Circuit said that the Food and Drug Administration approval of mifepristone could stand because too much time had passed to challenge that decision. But at the same time, they blocked more recent measures affecting the distribution of mifepristone and said that it couldn't be sent through the mail. It had to be prescribed by a doctor. So this whole drama is far from over. It's looking like it would likely head to the Supreme Court. We didn't realize that abortion would be back before the court so soon after the Dobbs ruling that overturned Roe. But this just shows that abortion is very high as a political issue and for sure will be an important issue driving especially young voter turnout in the elections next year.
The other problematic circumstance in all of this is the judiciary's involvement now in the Food and Drug Administration's ability to approve medication and verify that medication is safe and the rules that govern the distribution of medicine. Again, I'm a man. I'm speaking about something that women have to do if they are seeking medical attention. But this is such a circumstance fraught with so much emotion and concern. The ability to just have this access and know that there is the ability to have this access provides a comfort to some women who need to do this or need to seek access to this medicine. And throwing that all into flux just makes this entire process that much more complicated for those people who need to do this.
Absolutely. It's a very emotional and personal issue. Also, Linda, as you pointed out, the messaging of this issue is going to be very important in the months ahead as we go into the 2024 elections. But it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. So, Linda, what is weighing on your mind this week?
So I'm thinking about Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was detained 2 weeks ago in Russia. He was on a reporting trip in Yekaterinburg, was detained, accused of espionage. He's now been in Lefortovo prison for 2 weeks. Lefortovo is a historic and awful place to be held. It was started, I think, in the 1800s. The Tsar used to put his enemies there. Gershkovich has just been called by the U.S. government wrongfully detained, which is important because it puts him into the government hierarchy. That means that a dedicated State Department official is now on his case. This is yet another troubling sign in U.S.-Russian relations. And I know people who know Evan, talented young reporter, the son of Soviet Jewish emigres. We don't know why they grabbed him in particular, but other American reporters who have bravely been in Russia since the war in Ukraine started, many of them have now left the country because nobody can take that chance. And, you know, who knows how long Evan will be in, but we're all watching this closely.
Yes. Thank you. And Kane.
Well, actually, if I can lighten it up a little bit, it's not so much weighing on my mind, but it's been the topic that I've been covering really for the last year and a half. And now just with the recent news, NASA has announced that we are going to go back to the moon, and they successfully tested Artemis 1 back in the fall. And just in the last week, NASA has announced the crew that will make the first crewed mission back to the moon. This crew will orbit, not land on the moon, but they will travel further than any humans have traveled into space when they make this journey. The announcement of the crew, it's Victor Glover, Reid Wiseman, Christina Cook, and the first Canadian astronaut. The makeup of this crew is going to be the first woman, first international astronaut, and the first African-American astronaut to travel to the moon. So not only is this mission going to get us back into space, ostensibly achieving goals with the purpose of getting to Mars, it's doing so in a far more diverse and representative way for the agency and for all of not just America, but the world. So we'll be seeing people going back to the moon, representing a wide cross section of the globe as they do it. And so I think it's an exciting time to be alive, to be able to witness and watch this. And for me, it's been extremely rewarding to be able to cover it and be involved in this.
Very nice. Thank you. And I hope you are able to go to cover that. And we will end the show on those thoughts. My thanks go to our panelists, Christian Science Monitor, Washington Bureau Chief Linda Feldman, and VOA Midwest correspondent Kane Farabaugh. I'm Kim Lewis, and thank you for listening. And be sure to join us next week for more Issues in the News.